speaking. I'd also like to add that listening to Julie has always left me terribly inspired to share what I know about the AIDS epidemic, about HIV virus, to those I work with and those I come in contact with. Julie Lightman.
I'm going to try to cover some of those questions that I got in writing, but if other things occur to you, if you just want to raise your hand and holler out, we'll be a little bit informal about them. Is it safe in assuming that most of you can project your voice? Yeah, if you have any trouble, have someone next to you holler out. I want to cover sort of three basic areas today, and what I'm going to do in each of those areas is to give a quick overview of basic facts, so that if anybody's not sort of been through a basic introduction to information about AIDS, we're all up to snuff on that. And then to give you an idea of each area, what have been the changes in the past year and what are the challenges down the road for us in those areas. I'm going to cover first some information about AIDS, what it is, the disease progression, treatment of the disease, and so on. And then secondly, talk a little bit about transmission. Make sure we're all clear about how the virus is and is not transmitted, and talk about trends in transmission also in this state and in the United States. And then finally, talk about prevention. I want to make sure that we don't sort of run over so we don't have time for that, because that's really what we're all about, is talking about prevention and how we can have an effect on this epidemic. And then at the end, I will leave time to talk about workplace issues for those of you who want sort of a quick overview of how AIDS is impacting people in the workplace, and particularly what the legal situation is in this state regarding an employee who might have HIV. Ready? Here we go. That's our math. I want to start first just with sort of basic vocabulary to make sure that everybody's sort of singing off the same song sheet when we use the words that we use in talking about AIDS, particularly to make a differentiation between what we mean by AIDS and HIV. Basically, AIDS is an endpoint in a disease that really ought to have all along been called HIV infection. And one of the images that you may be familiar with in talking about this, blue water and everything, is the iceberg. As you can see, I was not hired for my artistic skills, and you'll have to sort of bear with me, but this is an iceberg, in case you couldn't tell. But the iceberg helps us to sort of get a picture of this epidemic. Let me sort of paint the iceberg for you two different ways here, real simply. The first is from the point of view of an individual. Very simply put, an individual who becomes infected with HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus, moves up the iceberg over time. That's a very simple way of putting it. Very basically put, at first a person is infected, and for a number of years is what we call HIV positive. In other words, infected with the virus and would test positive, but during that stage has no symptoms of the infection at all. At this point in time, for people who have had HIV to this date, most of them are spending an average 10 years in that first stage of no symptoms at all. Then we move into a stage which has been called ARC, or AIDS-related complex. It's an awkward stage to talk about at this point in the epidemic because it's kind of a catch-all. What's happening at this stage is that some symptoms are developing, but they don't yet fit into the tight definition of full-blown AIDS, which is at the tip of the iceberg. And this kind of symptoms that a person has with ARC vary a lot from person to person, but they tend to be mono or flu type of symptoms. If you've ever had mono, you can relate to that fatigue sort of a feeling, and I'm assuming that all of you have had the flu, and you can relate to those sorts of symptoms that a person might have at that stage in terms of a high fever or swollen glands, things like that. And to date, most people have spent somewhere between 1 to 3 years at that stage. And then finally, we have what's known as full-blown AIDS, and as I mentioned, this is a very tight definition. There's literally a list of infections and diseases that a person once you have one of those, you qualify to move up into full-blown AIDS. So that ART category is sort of any type of symptom that does not yet fit into that type definition of AIDS. That's a real simple overview. Right now. Well, yes and no. I would say three different thoughts that we've had about that over the past few years. I would say about 3 years ago, people would say not necessarily. A lot of things you saw in writing said maybe 40-50% of people with HIV infection will progress to AIDS. Then over a couple of years, as we had more experience with people having HIV infection, we saw that as more and more time went on, more and more people were progressing. And it was thought to be a progressive disease that eventually, perhaps given enough time, maybe 15, 20 years, a person would inevitably move up because of the effect on the immune system. Now we have a slightly more conservative view on that because of the improvements in treatment. In particular, most of you have probably heard of AZT. And AZT and several other medications like that, which are slowing down that progression considerably. And making this a disease that rather than being a progressive and even thought of as a terminal disease, something we would refer to as a chronic disease, that might be manageable, something like having MS might be, where you might have it throughout your life and might have episodes in which you did have symptoms, but it might be 30, 40, 50 years that a person is living with that before moving on in those stages. So I would say, in terms of the effect on the immune system at this point, there is nothing to stop that progression, but we're slowing it down such that it's making it a very different disease. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And it was that some people actually die from ARC and the symptoms of ARC. Particularly one of the main symptoms there is a severe weight loss, and that may be one of the things that can cause death at that point. Also, some people don't experience a state that's like ARC. It may be that it's not always as clean cut as it looks up here on an individual to individual basis, but it helps for getting the overall picture of the disease. Other questions or comments about that? I wanted to say something a little bit more detailed. Several people asked questions in the questionnaire about what's happening in terms of medications and treatment for people with probably one of the biggest news items and a couple other medications like that in terms of how it's changing the face of this epidemic. The other thing that I would add is that there are a lot of improvements in treatments for the illnesses that people with AIDS are experiencing. And again, that's making it a much more manageable disease at that point. In terms of options for cures or vaccines, something that would actually eliminate the virus from the body or protect the body from infection, much, much more difficult task. And I don't sort of see anything hopeful on the horizon, although there is some research going on in that area. I recently saw our Surgeon General, or ex-Surgeon General at this point, ask that same question. What do you think about the hopes for a cure vaccine? And his answer was, well, if you ask all the experts who are working in that field, they sort of divide up into three camps. There are those who say, we think we'll have one in the 1990s. And when pressed, they say probably late in the 1990s. And a second group that say probably in the next century. And a third group that say they don't believe will head out pretty evenly and all pretty reputable. So there isn't sort of one voice on how likely that is. And that's sort of coming from my personal opinion on that is that we need to plan as if we may not have such a thing, lest that turn out to be the case. Other questions people have about medication treatment? Yeah, I think about this, particularly in line of AZT. If you've read recently at the comments about one of the most recent studies about that, it was people who were in sort of the upper half of this HIV positive stage here being given AZT, that even at that early point, it's making a big difference in terms of how quickly people are moving on to symptoms. What that means is we need to be more aggressive about helping people to identify themselves and find out that they're HIV positive. Several years ago, there were mixed opinions about whether it was useful for people to go in and get tested and find out that they're infected. It might be useful personally, but there was not much that could be done medically. And now that's changing as we see that earlier and earlier in this disease, we can treat and make a difference. And so
there's sort of a switch going on that we need to be encouraging more people who are at risk to come in and get tested because they need to be followed for Yeah, if you couldn't hear the comment, AZT is very toxic. It's not easy to tolerate. And some people after 2 or 3 years simply have to go off of it because of the effect that it's having on their body. So experiments going on now with lower dosages and mixing it with other medications to try to get around that. But it's not going to be all on and off. No, at this point, actually, they talked about the upper half here. What we're talking about is as someone moves up the iceberg, you can test level of their immune system, their T cell count. As a person moves up, their T cell count drops. And at a certain point here, when it drops below 500, that's the point at which now you can use ACT. I want to kind of look at the iceberg a little bit differently now. Switch from looking at it from the point of view of an individual who would be moving through those stages and look at it from the point of view of the epidemic as a whole. And really, here's where we get that picture of the iceberg and having a much larger number of people below the surface of the water here. I'm not sure how much you've covered statistics to start with, but let me just give you a few simple ones. And if you have any questions, we can get into statistics. We sort of don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that. Full-blown AIDS then. I'll give you the statistics in terms of the United States as a whole and then also specifically in Minnesota. In the United States now we're over 115,000 cases. In Minnesota we're upstairs are referring to all of the cases to date, and so they include the people who have already died as well as those who are living with full-blown AIDS. Usually it's our people who have died and people who are living. And then as you look below the surface there, the number of people who are infected in the United States is estimated between 1 and 1.5 million people. And in, not to get bogged down in statistics, just to help you get that picture of the iceberg there, that when we talk about how is this epidemic progressing, that we need to get that picture of what's down the road for us, that we still have at this point, even if we take the conservative end of those estimates, a large number of people who are already infected, and that's what lays down the road for us in terms of needing to provide services and the kind of personal impact that it's going to have on each of us. When you look just in Minnesota alone, and again, 10,000, that's a large part of why we need to be talking about being prepared for the personal impact, even if I know how to protect myself from becoming infected, I'm going to be affected by the epidemic. By knowing people who are infected, perhaps in my workplace, perhaps in my personal life. And particularly, as we look down the road in terms of providing services, several people ask questions about, are we prepared in Minnesota? Do we have enough services in place? How are we doing compared to other care industry? What about insurance and so on? All very good questions. I would say in terms of services in Minnesota, we're in pretty good shape. We have an advantage in this epidemic that as a state, we've been a little bit behind in the epidemic, and we've been able to recognize as changes are happening on the coasts on both sides, that that may be what lies down the road for us, and we can follow their example or learn from their mistakes in preparing here. When I speak to some of my colleagues who are in states that have very high incidence, they can't believe how much time we have to prepare for this. It doesn't feel like it to me. But from their point of view, they are running around trying to just keep all the pieces in place in a really sort of a crisis management sort of perspective. Whereas here we have a little bit of an advantage of being able to take some time to sit back and say, are we prepared? And let's make sure we are prepared. One of the efforts that I'm aware of that's going on right now in Minnesota is a grant received by the State Health Department to do a needs assessment of services for people with HIV and AIDS and people who are affected by it, for instance, their friends, lovers, and family. Are we prepared? What's already out there? What are agencies doing? What are the needs, and are those needs being met? Let's make sure we're not duplicating services. So I think we're in a pretty good spot in that regard in terms of services in Minnesota. In terms of the effect on the healthcare system, going to be a little bit overwhelmed. If you look down the road into the 90s, let's not be looking at the number of people who are going to be becoming ill. And actually the trend that we look at in terms of HIV infection becoming more of a chronic disease may need more medical care. That rather than I becoming acutely ill, and dying within a few years, I'm going to need medical management over 20, 30 years, regular visits, medications, and so on. It's a good trend, but it's an expensive trend in terms of the healthcare industry as well. Boy, I wish I had some numbers. I think the insurance industry wishes they had some numbers in terms of what kind of impact is it going to have. I think probably the most telling fact about that is that if you look at many of the AIDS education materials and programs that are in place in this country, a lot of them are underwritten by insurance companies, and that's not coincidental. They recognize the effect that this epidemic may have on them if we don't do everything we can to curb it. Are there more specific questions than that that people had about the long-term impact in terms of the numbers? That's why I'm answering your questions. Yes. Bruce is talking about if you have a little trouble getting a handle on how big is a million and a half, that it comes out to about 1 in 200 people in the United States being HIV positive. Yes. Yeah. And I certainly wouldn't want to lull us into complacency that, well, we're in good shape, don't worry. Yeah. Other questions or comments on that? I want to move on and talk a little bit about transmission of the virus, make sure that we're all clear about that, and then also answer any questions that you might have about it. I'm going to be here again for a while so that you don't have to sort of listen to my voice for an hour. I'm going to take an approach that I find a little bit helpful in talking about this. I think probably most of you are aware that there's considerable confusion in the general public about the transmission of this virus. One of the things that has added to that confusion has been a little catchphrase that's one of my thorns in my flesh, which is exchange of body fluids. I'm not sure who coined that phrase. I'd like to meet them. But I tend to think that it was somebody who was not real comfortable saying certain words in public. And they did us a great disservice in thinking that they were being polite. And I'm going to have us sort of let our hair down and get a little bit more specific by what we mean by body fluids. And in order to do that, I think they said, I'll let you do the talking and I'll do a brainstorming. You know brainstorming rules, just shout it out, nothing's right, nothing's wrong. And we will simply list all the body fluids that we can think of. And then we'll separate that list and make it clear about which ones do in fact pass HIV and which ones do not. So this is your turn here, right?
And then there are these others that are included in that list that you really don't want to know about, like, and the list of In Kansas. Well, they're probably very familiar to you in terms of people talking about HIV. I think at this point, in terms of talking about these three fluids getting in, so you see there's nothing magical about that list of how HIV, in terms of a little bit about how risky they are and how common they are. Some of these are far more sexual transmission, at least in this country. We have 75% of our cases, roughly, that in terms of sharing needles or cookers or other drug equipment, that accounts for roughly another 20% of our cases. Are you with me? 95%. What is the face of this epidemic and how do we need to address it? Sexual transmission and IV drug use is by far the bulk of the issue there. Some of these things up here, I would say, are very low risk. Even accidental exposure, for instance, two cuts, if somebody were bleeding and you have a cut on your hand, there have been cases of transmission like that, but it's not an easy way to pass this virus. It's very fragile and needs to go directly from body to body. And then when you get into talking about things even more direct like that, for instance, what if there had been blood on food or on a product, eating utensil or drinking utensil, your risk gets so small that that would happen. That, you know, we've had no cases, and I expect no cases. Probably a good thing to keep in the back of your mind when you think about accidental exposure is that the foods that we're talking about need to be moist in order for the virus to be viable. So in other words, if I were to have bled, let's say, on a razor that I had used, and then it were sitting on the edge of the bathtub, as soon as any amount of blood that is on there has dried, that virus has died. Because of that, I say it's really unlikely that I were to use a razor and bleed on it, probably a tiny amount of blood.
In fact, we as a community with 40 organizations and programs, 19 of our institutions instituted small, but I say that's not enough. You will be hearing a lot about statistics and a lot of information, and I really can't offer you that, but I thought what I can bring is my own perspectives and my own fears as you today. And it's a perspective that is narrow. It's not all the issues. There are so many issues that we always face. But I thought that's really the thing that I can offer all of us today. Issues that I've had to confront facing AIDS are homophobia, sexism, racism, denial and fear of death, many, many more. In 1979, I was living in New York. And get sick with the community. No one knew what it was. About sore throats. And about talking that maybe it was a CIA plot. I still haven't given that one up. Some of us thought it was just another strain of BD and another shot of penicillin would cure it. By 1981, the government learned how to count some of them. There were 200 theories about the gay plague. 1982 arrived. The denial by the federal government that anything existed, that anything was treated. 3,000 cases. And then it was the 4-H theory. AIDS, the homos, Haitians, hemophiliacs, and heroin addicts. Total denial by the government that something was totally out of control. 1984, 7,500 cases. Still in the Hodge, I confirmed bachelor, refused to acknowledge anything for fear of losing the tours. Trained in New York City. There was no plague in New York City. A lot of people were dead though. 1985 seemed to be the watershed year for consciousness. Broadcast of knowledge. 16,000 cases of AIDS existed down in Atlanta. In print broadcast, then the President of the United States. Still did not have a press conference in response to something. Did he first acknowledge after 16,000 cases were listed that this existed? 1986, the count now was 29,000 cases. AZT was introduced this year, promising extended life expectancies. Unfortunately, two insurance company saw no reason to lower that cost. And then the French and the American scientists were each stealing each other's research so they could be the first one to discover the cure, so they could win their Nobel Prize. 1987, 49,000 cases. Insurance companies really got nervous that year. They started denying whole categories for health insurance. Entertainers, designers, florists, regardless of their sex, were totally denied their health insurance. Companies began to refuse employees for lifestyle diseases. The immense health crisis in New York was denied federal funding from an amendment by Senator Jesse Helms because it was promoting homosexuality. 1988, 1,400 cases. We saw homes burn. We saw communities refusing to have hospices built in their neighborhoods because it would bring the wrong types of people. We saw doctors refusing to operate on people because they did not want to risk their own life. 1989, 116,800 cases of AIDS is listed. But the realization is that they never knew how to count, and they really don't know how to count now. There's no way that the government has realized that there really is no way to count what has happened in our society. South Carolina last year went through 600,000 medical studies of all public hospitals in the state of people who were diagnosed as what the symptoms were in all of these cases. And they found that African Americans and women were more than twice as likely than white men to be reported improperly. It's very clear now. Estimates are there are 1 million people in America. About 635 identified cases have been counted, and the estimates are there are 10 to 20,000 of HIV. That's kind of the most astonishing thing. People try to put numbers to that. There's 6 in Central Africa. 4% of the population in the urban centers involves more people to AIDS than we did in crimes. Years ago, when I was at the Pew Foundation, and I interviewed for the Foundation Fund, the night before I did that, I made a list, because I keep journals. I sort of get staggered at the numbers. What I'd like us to do now is to for each of us to imagine the face of AIDS. What the face of AIDS looks like? We've been told a deal in society about what AIDS is, what it looks like, what it feels like. And I thought I would show some of us today sort of about what society has told us AIDS is. And then all to go beyond that. It's a powerful community that we mentioned. Society has taught us to think of AIDS as dying. We really need to think of AIDS dying. Many museums have shown this. This is a series that he did with a man named Tom Moran. And it begins, it's over a 5 month period. This is Tom with his mother in August 1987. Go back and think about what we imagine is the case of AIDS. We can't deny what was happening in the gay community. The society is really now denying things that are happening in all of our communities. AIDS is a major killer of women between the ages of 25 and 34 in New York City. 6 babies in New York City every month is being born as children, of color. In the United States, 51% of all women with AIDS, 51% of all women with AIDS in America are Hispanic. Another percent, 2% in the population, 3% are Hispanic. So that community really look to design education for the communities we want to reach. An aspect of us learning how to deal with living with AIDS is a society that's to deal with realities. And later on today, we'll be here since PWA is about to do it all. In 1979, you and I, with two of us, there are now front-runner clubs here in 20 cities in America. We're interested in racing, and Lee and I trained. I talked to Lee last week because I told him I wanted to talk about his story today. He's having a very hard time seeing me. 3 years ago, went on ACT, and I'm sure we'll hear about this later and make up the numbers more, but I was just like 800 or something, 800 bucks, I don't know. Down below 400, and that qualified me to get to ACT. Being tested in Britain. And Lee was one of the 6 test sites in America. And Lee got on this trip. And the combination of NREG, quite that NREG wasn't being tested rigorously enough, even though in each of the 6 cities was showing remarkable results. The company, they had to go back and start over again after the drug company spent 5 years. The companies forget it. They dropped it. Plans and sales. Responding to AIDS. The government and the FDA, and criminally, 1989, the FDA began to speed up. I think we have to thank ACT UP for that. I then went back and found some wonderful media examples, and they're all from 1987, about how the media has treated us. Of course, it's not really much different. How the media's treated other things. I found a nice quote in the New York Times in 1866. Cholera is the curse of the dirty, intemperate, and the degraded. In 1987, a lot of the media focused on things were safe in our society, that it was still 4-H. Here's my favorite cover in U.S. News. It's January 1987. What do you need to know? I think the reference were even less generous, but not really different in tone. In U.S. movies, over 2 years I was at the Pew Charitable Trust. And it was kind of an interesting community in denial. So we did not allow the health department to apply for federal because that wasn't an issue in Philadelphia. So, at the foundation, we pulled together some of the civic, the business leaders, and some of the political leaders. This task force, a commission, to look at AIDS. This is a lot of recommendations that no one read.
I'll keep talking and let you know if you can hear me. In the back of the tension, great tension, okay? I met with many of the surgeons, and the social Darwinism at work. It really wasn't a response society needed to make. It would take care of itself.
Living. Better spent on the living. Better spent. Also at this time that I was asked to advise Nancy Reagan's brother, who was a surgeon at the University of Pennsylvania, and the president was putting together his AIDS commission at that time. So I was called in, and I was asked, because now I was the AIDS expert in Philadelphia, what people naturally might be good to sit on the commission. But I was told that the president had a problem with people with alternative lifestyles, that on the AIDS commission they didn't want any homosexual people on the commission because it would politicize the report. They eventually did put Frank Lilly on the commission. Great man, one of the bombs the game has happened months. It was also during this period that I attended my first Council on Foundation meeting, it was on in Atlanta, and I held on to it. It was a very conservative. But we were too busy at that meeting in the National Forum to have days on the agenda, so we had to meet at a pre-breakfast meeting. This is 1987, a pre-breakfast meeting, because it could not fit on the agenda of the Council on Foundation. So we met an extraordinary group of people at that meeting who have really transformed. So in 1987, the Ford Foundation commissioned a study. The giving patterns of foundations. And this slide shows, I'm sorry I got a copy from the book so you can't read it, but this is from 1981 to 1987, the foundation giving patterns for AIDS. Me or Bob or the folks in this room can tell us that, because I think that the pattern's very different now. But, you know, we're up to 1987 and what were the numbers, you know, thousands of people sick. And our foundation's response was the largest section, 58.8% was for medical research. Then 20.5% for public health. 17.8% for medical research. 1.2% for healthcare. 1.1% for equal rights. 0.3% for mental health. 0.3% for medical needs. And 0.3%. We have to thank those people like Cynthia that have transformed in America this issue. But so putting this together, I thought, well, really, what is the face of AIDS in our the issues? The issues really are in our government. Our government talks so much more about testing than it does about treatment. He's so much more interested in those who eventually may be threatened by AIDS than those of us to have AIDS. This is all about quarantine. Maybe you can say it's just crazy. Maybe somehow it didn't seem to stop. You know what happened in World War II for tens of thousands of Japanese Americans?
So I don't think it is too far fetched.
The society really is about to quarantine us. It's to me, as the President's Commission said, the two presidents got together to announce a joint fraternity demonstration with gloves on and they'll put their masks on later. Jerry Falwell said, AIDS is God's judgment for a society that does not live by his rules. Translation. He says, we used to hate faggots on an emotional basis. Now we have years ago the AIDS Commission met in St. Paul. And her conclusions were that the government has been quite lax. This is our State Commissioner of Health. AIDS is far too often confused as a moral problem to change in this time. AIDS brings an already existing social debate that is the purpose and value of the crisis. It grows in the relief that our work is based not simply or romantically on personal visions. Threatened right now. The ADA is being threatened. The freedom of expression is being threatened. According to Seth, 2 months ago, I received a copy of some AIDS comic books that are being distributed by the Gay Men's Health Crisis of New York City, which has received $674,679 in federal dollars for so-called AIDS education and information. These comic books told the story in graphic detail of the sexual encounter of two homosexual men. Don't encourage or change any of the perverted behavior. In fact, comic books promote sodomy and homosexual lifestyles as an acceptable alternative to American society. I believe that if the American people saw these books, they would be on the verge of revolt. I obtained one copy of this book, and I had photostats made for about 15 exceptions. The senators were revolted. They suggested to me that President Reagan ought to know what was being done on the pretense of AIDS education. So about 10 days ago, I went down to the White House and I visited with the President. And I said, Mr. President, I don't want to ruin your day, but I feel obliged to hand you this and let you look at it. See what is being distributed. And I opened the book, looked at a couple of pages, shook his head, hit that desk and this. I'm going to put Senator Reynolds' lot of things. I've served 4 years in the Navy. I've been around the track. But every Christian, religious, moral ethic within me cries out to this country. It's embarrassing to stand on the Senate floor and talk about the details of this travesty. Again, I quote from Senator Hunt, "We've got to call a spade a spade, and a perverted human being is a perverted human being." Your AIDS case can be traced to a homosexual act. Amendments I introduce will force this country to slam the door on the way for sexual revolution, which has ravaged this nation the past quarter of a century. It's testing on a broad national level. And unless we get around to that and stop talking about all this business of civil rights and so forth, we will not stop the spread of AIDS. We used to quarantine from typhoid fever and scarlet fever. We did not ruin the civil liberties of anyone to do that. Only 2 cents in person. And again, that's all priceless. We'll go back. Rabbi Meyer White, who's spectacular show has just opened at the Institute, is a great community. He also chose to perhaps lead his life with part of life. Very nice man. A great artist. But somehow the Senator Helms followed the controversy in the storm, and again Senator Helms put Ron on top of this to the Senator, saying, "This is the end." So we have to protect both of those things in our hearts. We have to absolutely protect, also must protect the context of our heartbeat, the context of our artist's lives, and allow our artists to live their life. It's fully. I don't want to run much more with statistics, but she brings to her work in the service. Some of us, we just sit around the table and sort of yell out numbers and talk and have a wild discussion, but gay men report having sex with married men. And a percentage. There's doctors report that what percentage of their clients are married. Some view as a sexual behavior of gay men. Heterosexual women, 1%. The survey of 1,000 physicians, what percentage agreed that their attitudes towards male homosexuals adversely affected their medical treatment of such patients? We're at the 5th International Conference on AIDS. What percentage of physicians believe that AIDS is a result of God's wrath towards homosexuals? How many states in the United States have or has statewide legal protection of homosexuals against discrimination? Determine that homosexuals may compromise what percentage? A completed percent. What myths about AIDS? That it's a gay plague, that we get it from the nuclear force, and that the heterosexual community. I think that everyone now understands how HIV transmission occurs. The Gallup organization did a poll and found out some kind of astonishing things. 44% of those polled so that you get AIDS from donating blood. Not from getting blood, from donating blood. 16% of those polled by the Gallup organization, this is November 1989, thought they could get AIDS. 13% thought they could get AIDS if they were coughed or sneezed at. 11% thought they could get it from the toilet seats. We have to educate. I've only spoken about my fears. Any of us that come up and talk about our fears, we must present, we must nurture artists, and make it clear this summer talking that we have really given up that right in the cultural community. We are not acting as voters. We are not acting as public. It's a wonderful button. It says, "I am the public." And we are the public. And we have to not here as an arts community to help create work so we can transcend this epidemic, to make ourselves feel better about this epidemic. Here's an arts community to end it, to stop it.